This is Power Athlete Radio. With your hosts, Denny K, Professor Booty, and the Luke Summers. And now, toes forward, hips locked, shoulders set, and retract those scapulas. It's time for some knowledge bombs.
Nation, welcome to episode 71 of Power Athlete Radio. We got a good one today, as always. Tom Canavy, former strength and conditioning coach of the Minnesota Vikings, 20 plus years in the field of strength and conditioning, joins us today. And I have the man himself, John Wellborn.
What's happening?
Summers.
What's up?
And Tex McQuilkin. What's happening, gentlemen?
So I don't get a Z in front of my name?
No, Tex, you got to earn that.
Not yet, yeah.
It takes a high school state championship
either.
Well, that and also, you know, you can't even refer to anybody as the that gives himself their own nickname.
Mm-hmm. This was a gift, John. I never gave it to myself.
Hey, this is Tom Canavy, guys. Thanks for having me on, man. It's a pleasure.
Tommy, it's great to finally get you on the podcast. We've been after you for about a year since we started this thing to get you on here. Not only are you one of the more knowledgeable people we've ever had on this deal, especially in terms of professional strength coaches, you know, 20 years experience, but also one of my personal favorite people on the planet, Tom Canavy. So we have a lot of history and have been friends for a long time, and hopefully we'll regale with some really good stories, especially the one about Metallica coming off stage as I see Tommy Canavy handing them towels and high-fiving James Hetfield and the guys. So,
if it requires publishing a good story, go right ahead. I'm with you.
Hey, that's John. That's where that picture comes from. That's been posted on the football site.
Yeah, that's where that one. We were at Veterans Stadium last show at the Vet for Metallica, and we're like side stage. Everybody's having a great time. Tommy was there, and all of a sudden we look up on stage, and like we're kind of off to the side. And all of a sudden I see, like, behind the stage, I can see Canavy back there, like, rocking out. All of a sudden, Metallica finishes, and they come off, and I see Canavy handing them towels. And, like, the guys are, like, high-fiving them, and I'm like, how the fuck did he get up there? And is he handing those guys towels?
You want to know how that happened, John? Real quick, I'll make this quick. As you remember, the radio station that broadcast the Eagles games, the official home of the Eagles, was also the local rock station.
Yeah, so WMMR.
Yeah, WMMR, we got hooked up big time, and they put us in the journalism or the journalist pit, the photographer pit. Yep. And we were thrashing and moshing, and, you know, all these people were there from the newspapers and whatnot trying to take pictures. And they accused me of not being a real photographer, even though I had credentials. So I took out, like, my that little Kodak Instamatic disposable, and I was like hanging upside down and turning, bending sideways and twisting and hanging from a bar somewhere taking pictures. And they got sick of me making a spectacle out of myself, trying to prove I was a professional photographer. They didn't want to throw me out and tick off the radio station, so they put me right behind the stage, and I was practically the fifth member of Metallica that night. But it was legendary. And, you know, hey, yeah. I'm used to handing out towels in the weight room, so I just felt right at home helping James and Lars.
It was awesome, dude. It was probably one of the funniest moments. We're like, wait a minute, how did he, what? So, yeah, no, that was one of the best times we had. I mean, more than a few others, but it was a pretty good one. So let's jump in on this thing and get rocking.
Yeah, well, let's start with questions because, I mean, John's been at tears telling stories about Canavy for, like, the past year and how great and epic this show is going to be. And I know a lot of people like to get their training information first. So let's talk a little bit about training. So Tom, before we even start, why don't you just give a kind of a resume or background or CV on who you are, what you do, where you've been, that type of shit.
Okay. Well, I got into strength and conditioning as a failed athlete. As Wellborn will tell you, I was, in high school, I was 6'2", 165 pounds. I wanted to play tight end and defensive end, just like my dad. The coaches watched me run a route and said, go there with the lineman. Immediately, the line coach saw me coming and said, get right in the weight room. If you want to survive, you better get in the weight room. And being a pretty poor athlete was the best thing that ever happened to me for my career and my family, because I lived in the weight room. I was the winter workout leader every year and proceeded to stink out the joint when it came to playing. So I knew I wanted to pursue a career in football. And I knew it was going to be not on the field as one of the athletes. So I stayed with strength and conditioning. I got into it in the early 90s now. And that was the Cold War of free weights versus machines. A lot of misconceptions. Power lifters and Olympic lifters avoided each other. It was very territorial. So I was fortunate to get my start to learn high intensity training, the dirty word, the HIIT system, in its purity, what it really is about. And we could talk about that later. But then I quickly went to the University of Miami, Florida in 1993 when they were number one in the country. And they had all the superstars down there. And they were a real hardcore Eastern Bloc Olympic program. So I learned two styles early on. And I used to meld them together the best I could, planning my own program when I would one day be my own head strength coach with some program. And when John and I met in Philadelphia, I was an assistant strength coach. And thank you very much. I was very loyal to the program that was being run there at the time. And we could talk about where strength and conditioning was at in the 90s and into the 2000s. But my background is I would never box myself into a singular philosophy. I would just brand what I do as progressive overload. It's technique based. It's power producing. And it's free weight. It's a basis of free weights to develop strength, power, and athleticism, and then by any means necessary, condition all of the major metabolic pathways. So that's kind of a long story, but if you want to give what I do a name, it's progressive overload. When a guy needs to get pushed faster and harder, we throw the percentages out the window and we go harder. When a guy's not complying with technique and he needs to back up a little bit, percentages go out the window, and we base every workout based on the preceding workout. So it's a long storied road that I took throughout a lot of different philosophies, but that's where it's at today.
So Tommy, you much like us figured out that percentages are great in a perfect world, but unfortunately we live in an imperfect world. Athletes are dealing with different demands, whether it's playing the sport and a million different factors, injuries and whatnot. And when you start becoming a slave to percentages, you end up missing a lot. And being able to go in there and actually program or write something or go take a guy through a workout, and then all of a sudden on those days where he's feeling good, I mean, we talk it all the time, man. It's like the gambler, dude. You got to know when to fold it, know when to hold them. And like, you know, we go in the weight room and somebody's itching for it, you know, you got to be able to ramp up intensity, increase the weights. If you come in and somebody's, you know, obviously, you know, not performing well or a little beat down or whatnot, you got to be able to pull it back. And the problem is when you get slave to percentages, you know, you get stuck within that rut and can't necessarily make the changes you need to make.
Absolutely. That's absolutely right. I mean, that's true and tested, because over 19 years, when you try to stick with the percentages, you always run into that. And the competent strength coaches, even though they're dedicated to their philosophy and dedicated to their system, they know that when it's on the line that these guys have to develop, and it's about winning games and having players at their strongest and having players available to play and not injured. All these strength coaches deviate from the percentages. I think linear periodization is a great format to lay down when you begin a program and go into it knowing you're going to be making changes, man. I mean, John, a great Philadelphia analogy I use when I try to explain this to the position coaches is, you know, in Philadelphia, we have Broad Street, and that's your linear periodization. Broad Street goes right down the center of Philadelphia. The whole team's going to march down Broad Street following this linear periodization program. But guess what? As soon as we get a few blocks, these guys are going to be taking a right down Chestnut. These guys are going to be making a left down Walnut. These guys are going to be going down, you know, making a right turn. Everyone starts to get individualized as we move along. So you can't get stuck in that rut of linear periodization. It's a great system in a perfect world. Going back to my days with the Hurricanes, I loved the program, and everything I learned in college was I saw it come to fruition in the room before my eyes. And I went through the manual, and basically, if you follow the percentages, you could go ahead 7 weeks from when you started and just tell what everybody's new max was going to be. You were going to work up to 105 or 110%. But, you know, you could really have filled in the numbers and turned in your results 7 or 8 weeks ahead of time. But in the real world, you come across, I mean, you alluded to games and injuries. Not only that, you know, when guys haven't got enough sleep, when guys are rested, and when they've experienced a gain, when they've experienced an adaptation at the age of 19 or 20 over the course of 1 week, they need to be ramped up. It could be a weigh-in day. They could have depleted themselves so they would make weight. They're not going to perform the same that day. There's so many variables that you have to be not only flexible, but knowledgeably flexible and know what to do with each individual player.
Amen.
So we'll jump right into one of a question we dropped or had dropped on the forum from a guy on our site named Sean. I'll just read it verbatim and then we'll paraphrase. Has Tom found that top tier college football programs have different strength and conditioning programs from lower level schools like D3? Are their athletes better prepared coming into the NFL? What are they doing that is less effective, that the less effective programs aren't? So I guess, you know, taking a look at, do you see a correlation between an athlete's ability to play in the NFL and the efficacy or legitimacy of their strength and conditioning program, D3 versus D1?
Well, for the most part, and Tommy can, you know, either jump in on this or not, but there really aren't that many D3 guys that actually even get a chance to play in the NFL, and those are just a handful. But I do not believe that that's necessarily, related to their strength and conditioning programs. What you're going to talk about is, you know, you look at a Division III school versus, we were using Michigan, for example. Michigan's obviously going to get the best athletes, sign the highest recruits, and bring in probably the best players they can to field their Michigan team. And obviously, by ipso de facto, those players are going to get a chance to go play in the NFL. We've seen coaches and teams that have completely different training philosophies. You can have a team like, you know, Penn State or Michigan that's, you know, high intensity interval training, hammer strength, posed from, let's say, like Tommy was referencing earlier, like University of Miami, which was Olympic lifting and, Russian induced program. And they're still going to put out the same amount of NFL players. They're still going to put out the same type of athletes. You're going to have a guy like Tom Brady come in and, you know, he's going to go out and do well. And really the only common denominator is, you know, they were great high school players. They went into a system where they had a ton of competition and they also had certain genetic, predisposition for these things. And then it allowed them to get to the NFL where they flourish. What we really have seen, especially in my experience, Tommy can speak to it a little bit longer, is, you know, if a guy comes into the NFL and he's not ready to play day one, or at least maybe a week or two, or even, you know, a few weeks or maybe even a month out of being able to play the game, he doesn't last around there very long. People have this idea that the NFL, you know, guy will come in and practice squad and develop. Practice squad guys are there, yeah, to get experience, but they're also there to give the starters a good look. And if they can't give a good look because you're not up to the fact, they cut you and get rid of you. So I think there's very little development in the NFL. If you're not ready to go, they're not going to wait for you. There's, very few projects in the NFL. So.
Right, John. And I think what you were speaking about right there, it's 100% true. It's, a lot to do with natural ability, genetics, and that's why they have hundreds of people on the recruiting staffs and why recruiting as the premium of college football. I firmly believe if you would switch rosters from your Division I teams with your Division III teams this season, at the end of the season, you're going to all of a sudden see about 80, 85, 90% of your NFL players coming from Division III. It's not all about the strength and conditioning program. It's about that frame and that natural potential and that size and speed that the athlete possesses coming in. If you sent all those blue chip recruits down to Division III and brought the D3 guys up to those 20,000 square foot weight rooms and palatial facilities, the D3 guys 4 years later, the way I feel, they're still going to be the ones getting to the NFL. And it is all about being ready when you get there. What I see coming into the NFL for 19 straight years, the past 19 years, I can't see an Alabama guy looking different from an Oregon player. Or I don't see a Cal guy that looks different from an LSU guy. What I see is, to me, they look very young. You see a guy in his early 20s, room for development, still developing, still maturing physically. And once he gets out of the college routine and has an entire offseason to dedicate his job just to training, there's going to be some filling out. There's going to be some increases in coordination. But you don't see, oh, here comes a kid from Western Michigan, and he's going to look totally different than the dude coming from Michigan. The guys that get selected, that get brought in, they're at a certain level of development. They have a certain level of talent. They just look young compared to the vets. But program to program, you're just getting the best of the best. And strength conditioning is important, but it's not going to strength conditioning will never change or sway the guys who divert into the National Football League and play the sport professionally.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, there's been guys like we talked about Scott Fujita, who came to Cal as a walk-on, you know, was already pretty talented, came in and busted his ass in the weight room and ended up going on and playing now in the NFL for, you know, 12 years. Now, was it that Cal just kind of effed up and everybody effed up and didn't necessarily evaluate this kid? Yeah, he came in as a walk-on and he was as good as the scholarship players and ended up going on, earning a scholarship in short order and going on and playing for the NFL. So was it something where he developed himself? Yeah, the kid developed himself, but he came in with a lot of natural ability and a good work ethic. So I think people always want to believe. I mean, it's kind of a joke in the NFL whenever you see the strength, you know, a team has a bad season and they fire the strength coach. That's usually the world's biggest smokescreen bullshit deal. They're like, oh, you know, we need a sacrificial lamb. We had a bad season. So we'll can the strength coach. And then that'll somehow, then everybody's like, oh, well, they probably weren't strong. They weren't in good shape. You know, it was the strength coach's fault. That's fucking bullshit. And it's always been the sacrificial lamb. And the strength coach has always been that guy. And it's just an easy deal. If you notice, if you fire the strength coach and then your season doesn't turn around, what happens? They fire you the next year. So it's almost like the way to stay off or and stay your job for one more season if you're in a bad situation. So I think, you know, from my experience, and I think Tommy and I were talking about this, when I came in as a rookie, I mean, I was drafted fourth round. I came in and after the mini camp, so I came back for OTAs, they cut all those guys in front of me. You remember Big George and Jerry Crafts and all those old dudes. Yep. And all of a sudden, I was the starter. And I'm like, dude, I'm a fourth round pick. And they're like, yeah, we drafted you to start this in the NFL. Fucking let's go. And I ended up getting hurt that rookie year and spent the rest of the year on IR. And I think that season, now, while that injury was as shitty as it was, gave me a chance for the first time in my life to, one, do nothing but train without having to play a season, and two, actually enough money in my pocket to actually eat. You know, in college, you're so far below the poverty line, and show up. And all I had to do every day was come in and rehab and lift weights. And I had these, you know, this young bright-eyed strength coach named Tom Canady, who Mike Wolf, who is our head guy, just kind of tossed me and said, hey, you deal with him, Tommy, because I wanted to do a little bit more than just the standard guy. And that was Tommy and I twice a day for that entire offseason when nobody was around. You remember, the guys didn't come back till March or April. So, I mean, for those first 3 or 4 months, it was me and Canady every single day.
Yeah, well, you know, John and I, obviously, we go way back, and that's not just build up for the show here or anything like that. It was, you know, 1999, we're going, what, 15 years back. And the situation was, like John just said, I was the assistant strength coach. You've got a rookie, a very important part of the future, but he's on injured reserve, prohibited from going back and playing that entire year. So during that 1999 season, you've got the head strength coach. You have to deal with 20 or 30 guys that are playing every Sunday, guys that are banged up, guys that don't feel like training, guys that want to overtrain. Where do you think your rookie injured reserve is really going to spend a lot of time? With the assistant strength coach. And especially a guy like John, who loves to train. We could talk this, you know, back before you got hurt. I mean, when you arrived in Philadelphia, I just remember you very eager and ambitious and, you know, wanting to be successful at the next level and walking into that weight room at Veterans Stadium. It was barely 1,000 square feet. It was a pillbox of a cinder block shelter. And seeing you just seeing you being demoralized and you were wanting to cry, looking around at this little weight room. But anyway, you know, you spent that first season just training, and then that next off season was so crucial. I mean, you never left. I mean, from January, the day after the season ended, you were there every day, and you see these great gains from guys that work hard from their first year in the NFL to the second, not because the program is so much better or the strength and conditioning is different in the big leagues at all. It's like you talked about. I mean, you're still at an age where your potential for maintenance of lean body mass is still on the rise for maximum lean body mass. You're also developing, you're still maturing physically at the age of 22, 23. And now, instead of classes and academics and having to be here, there, and everywhere, your full-time job, you're being paid, you wake up in the morning, and it's all about your training regimen. And that's why you got tremendous gains. And I can tell you this, and I mean it, and that's why I'm here today. Since 1999, I've never seen a guy on injured reserve show up January 1st, chomping at the bit, ready to get at it, dedicate his life to that next season, and not hit the wall and burn out by about April 1st. But you never did. And years later, Chad Greenway, a linebacker for the Vikings, was the same thing. ACL, first game as a rookie, and was on IR the entire year. And that dude came out, man, he made me very proud University of Iowa, because he was the John Welborn of 2006. He went straight through January through the OTAs and had a tremendous second year.
It's good stuff. Well, let's keep on Sean's post here, and I guess hopefully pretty short answer. What do S&C coaches look for with their athletes to ensure that they are recovering from workouts, in-season training workouts, to prevent injury or fatigue prior to the game? Does the athlete give you personal feedback and you trust them? Are they operating on certain percentages of their previous RMs so they're not like falling short or getting crushed based off of their lifts? Or do you just watch them in general and you can tell just by observing?
So in the NFL, the most paramount thing that I think everybody forgets is that performance on the field dictates everything else. Mm-hmm. If you put a guy into a situation in the weight room and he comes in and has a great workout and all of a sudden he goes out on the field and he does nothing but stink it up, first thing they're going to say is, well, you know what? You need to look at what you do on the field as your primary mode of action, and the weight room is a supplement to this. And, you know, I mean, Tommy, you've seen it for years, too. You know, I remember guys that were weight room warriors that couldn't go out and play dead. And I remember we'd always be like, great, that weight room is really doing a lot for you. Now, obviously, you can build and do a lot in the weight room, but when guys get so focused on it and they lose perspective that on the field is where we make our dough and not by banging weights, you know, they really, I think, you know, fall short on that. But, you know, in terms of being able to, you know, figure out where a guy is at, I mean, Tommy's going to tell you, he's as clued in as the coaches on an athlete's performance. If a guy came in, played great, the first thing Tommy's going to be looking at is, what did you do last week? Because that's exactly what we're going to do this week. That volume, that intensity, everything that you have that we did last week, let's try to keep replicating that. Now, if a guy comes in, he had a terrible game, you're going to go in, you're going to be like, what do you need to do? Do we need to work harder? Do we need to work less? Do you need more sleep? Tommy's going to look and try to figure out how to maximize each guy's potential, because there's a symbiotic relationship between Tommy's job as a strength conditioning coach and the wins and performance of his athletes. As we were talking about earlier, they love to sacrifice a strength coach for a bad season. So who's more clued into those guys' performance? And Tom, he's at practice, leads a warm up. He's standing there watching, and he's, you know, play by play, living and dying with these guys. I mean, every good strength coach I've been around was like, you know, how'd it go for you? You played great. You know, let's, you know, continue to do it. Don't change anything. Let's just keep working. And you know, and but then, you know what? Also, if a guy goes in and has a terrible game, the first thing the strength coach is going to think about is, what did we do different? What do we have to do to get this guy back on track?
Yeah, absolutely right. And that's where, as the strength coach, you have to be in tune with your coaches, position coaches, and your medical staff, your athletic trainers. And you have to have that one-on-one trust with each and every player. That's a difficult part of the job now. And, you know, that's if I'm getting off track by comparing it to, you know, the past 6 months, I've traveled around and met a lot of the guys I really respect outside of organized teams who run their own training centers, their own programs. And it's that's what you don't deal with in that private sector, with that off-season training where you have clients where, you know, you don't normally have unwilling customers. You know, in the middle of an NFL season, you have talented, important guys that you have to, it's your job, you're tasked with keeping them in shape and keeping them strong and keeping them in their optimal condition. And they don't always feel it. And you have to, and it's legit. Sometimes you have fatigue and you have wear and tear. And how are you going to manipulate that? How are you going to change what you're doing? Well, what you do is you have to ask the coach, how are they looking during practice? Practice dictates everything. If a guy's going through practice with heavy legs, bad technique, standing straight up, there's no bend, he's tired, we have to look at, you know, how he's living, how he's sleeping, on recovery, maybe tweaking that strength program a little bit. However, and again, that's where you deviate from that plan you have week number one. You may have to get a guy in going in a different direction just to increase the intensity, but drop the duration to incorporate, to increase the amount of rest time. And then you have to go with your athletic trainers. I was fortunate everywhere I've been to have a great relationship with the athletic trainer and his staff and the doctors. That's not always the case. Sometimes strength coaches and trainers, they don't see eye to eye, but hey, they're monitoring the hydration. Has this guy been low on fluids? And you know where it's going now, they're doing the GPS and they're monitoring distance during practice and which guys are, you know, putting on more distance than others. And that's the sports science route where things seem to be headed a little bit. But, you know, ultimately it gets back to, John, what you said about practice and that, you know, week to week, you have to tweak what you're doing based on that performance.
Well, and also, you know, the strength coach also serves a really interesting role, especially during the season. And Tommy, you can agree or just stay silent on this. But, you know, if a guy, the NFL is weird. If you're not playing well, the coaching staff will let you know in some interesting ways. Like all of a sudden the strength coach will come in, you come in for your workout and strength coach will be like, hey, how's it going? You're like, pretty good. So how's it going out there? You're like, oh, I feel like I did all right. It was a little rough. And he's like, well, you know what? You got to get that going. And you're like, yeah. He's like, you know, I had somebody stop by, asked a lot about you. And, you know, I'm just telling you as a friend, you need to get your shit going and you need to pick it up. And you know what? Or it might be the general manager. I remember Tom Modrak coming and walking over to me during stretch and made a comment to me where he's like, hey, how you doing? I'm like, I'm doing great. He's like, you know, you're doing real good out here. We're really proud of you. And just wanted you to know that you were my draft pick in this draft. So the better you do, the better I do, because I put my mind for you. And I remember looking and being like, oh. And then Rick Burkholder, who was our trainer, who had worked with Mo in Pittsburgh, was like, oh, I heard you had a chat with Mo today. I was like, you know, it's just one of those things where, especially as a young guy, you know, they come at you from a couple different ways. And, you know, there's this idea that, you know, I'm sure Tommy's been in a situation where the position coach of the strength or the head coach have come down and be like, we need more out of this guy. I need you to get a message to him, however you need to do it, that this guy needs to pick it up. Or, you know, and it's a really interesting deal, because the strength coach over every other position on that staff has a very intimate relationship with the players. I remember coming in for my, you know, Monday, Tuesday training sessions and, you know, coming in early and bullshitting with Tommy and Wolfie for, you know, 35, 45 minutes, having a cup of coffee and just kind of bullshitting. I mean, you know, the relationship with the strength coach is one that's different than any other coach on the staff. I mean, we can joke about, you know, Tommy and Steve Everett's Michigan versus Penn State bets. I mean, could you see one walking around with a hat with a dildo on it? No. But Tommy was walking around with a Michigan hat with a massive dildo on it.
He was an art major, so he was pretty creative where, you know, the typical bet would be you wear a hat of the opposite team of the opponent. You know, you have to wear a Michigan hat for a week, or you have to wear a Michigan jersey. But Steve Everett was a very creative art major from that artsy fartsy Michigan program. And yeah, if you had to wear a hat coming from him, you didn't know what exactly that would involve.
Massive dildo glued on, and then a half shirt that was like cut up and fringed. And Canavy comes in and was so dejected by having to do it, but a bet's a bet. And I think the strength coach, you know, that idea that you have to, you know, obviously click and you know, have a good relationship with the athletes you're working, but they also know that, you know, you're not, you know, fucking ratting them out, or that there's an honesty that this guy has my back, he's in my corner. And so it's like one of those deals. And I remember, you know, being in Kansas City and, you know, having that conversation with, you know, Jeff Hurd, who is a great strength coach and one of my favorite people in the world. But I mean, that similar situation where, you know, come in and he'll talk to you. And I always remember telling the young guys, I'm like, hey man, when the strength coach starts talking to you about certain things, pay attention, because it's just not coming out of the blue. He's telling you that because he either heard it, he had a conversation with somebody, and he's trying to help you. So you know what? Trust that guy, and that guy will have your back. You know, because as you know, players, it's a kind of a weird deal. You're out there performing for the team, but you're not always sure who's on your side, who's not on your side. And you know, the strength coach has always been a pretty good person for that. So.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, because what I learned as a head strength coach when I got that chance is now I'm in the staff meetings. Now I'm in the personnel meetings. And as you know, it's no big secret, if this is college and pros, when the staff gets together and has a meeting, the coaching staff and the scouts and the personnel people are there too. They are talking at length about each and every player, and if they're reaching their potential, and if they're fulfilling what they're supposed to be doing, contributing to the team. And it's ad nauseum. It goes on and on. And I think when you're in the position meeting with your position coach, that's another intimate relationship that you have to have, a close relationship. But that position coach is always on top of you, always critiquing you, always encouraging coaching. And I think after a while, you know, John, maybe it starts to just become like the train. It just keeps rolling and rolling and rolling. So when you're sitting as a strength coach and you're the one guy who knows each and every player on the roster, every player at every position, and you start hearing, you know, they weren't talking about this DB for 2 weeks. Now they're really going over him very thoroughly. you may go down and find that guy next time he's in the weight room and say a little something to him, you know, without giving away in respect to the coaches, to confidentiality, what they're talking about, but as doing a favor that, hey, man, like you said before, John, you got to start stepping it up. I mean, they're talking about your position at great length in these staff meetings, man. Just make sure you're doing everything you need to be doing. And then in turn, because you have to have that trust level and not be, like you're saying, the 5-0, whatever the player says back to me, like, hey, John, you know, how are things going? You know, I'm in the staff meetings and they're really, you know, focusing on the O-line and, you know, how the last couple of games have gone. Are you sure you're working hard, and tell me how things are going during practice? I'm trying to do you a favor, and you might come back to me and say, oh, that MFer is out to get me. And I'll take something, the feedback I get from the player, what's appropriate to go back to the coaches or whoever else to help the team. I'm going to do it, but I'm going to maintain that trust and confidentiality that if a player is telling me something in confidence, that's a level where it's got to stay between us. So it is a touchy situation. It's a fine line, but it definitely exists. And the strength coach, sometimes it's the trainer, sometimes it might be a scout, but it's often the strength coach is the guy with the tap on the shoulder based on how a player's been performing and what's being said about them. And it's all about helping the team in the end.
And people forget that scouts, this is another one that kind of trips people out. They think scouts are there to scout like other teams at college. Dude, those scouts, let's say, you know, when you play for the Eagles, there was probably 20 scouts, regional scouts, head scout. Those scouts were at practice. If they weren't on the road during training camp, they're all there. They might leave for a day or two, but they are out there writing scouting reports on every single player. Now, these are the guys that scouted you in college. They scouted you if you were another team to come in. And now all of a sudden, here they are, you know, they're scouting you and giving reports. And as Tommy said, they go to staff meetings. Those staff meetings usually start around 8:30 or 9 o'clock at night. I mean, our last meeting gets done probably around 9 o'clock, and those guys sprint to the staff meeting. And they're in those staff meetings until 2 or 3 in the morning during training camp, talking about what, I have no fucking idea, but it's usually some fucking nonsense. And, you know, are we evaluating? I mean, this thing has come down. This thing is such you don't even need to tell people how big a business this is. And these players, these coaches, their livelihood are living and dying with whether or not they can get these athletes to perform the way they need them to perform. And they don't overlook anything at their resource to make it happen, whether it's strength coach, whether it's a general manager coming, talking to a player, you know, the idea of, hey, I need you to do this because you're going to get, you know, whatever the way they need to motivate you, they will do it. And that's the nature of the NFL. And it's how they win games and why it's the biggest business in professional sports.
That's right. And you know what? It goes back to what we started talking about. The guys they bring in, the 90 guys these days that they bring in May after the draft, they're going to whittle that down to 53, and every single one of them counts. There's not a lot of room for long-term projects or underdeveloped guys, and whatever their college strength program was, it's the most ready guys. And as ready as you can be, you could come out of Cal or Oregon or USC as the king of the weight room, and you're still going to be room to develop, you know, to the next level as a game player, as playing your position better and developing physically, because where you're at in life at that age in the 20s. But when you talk about those long, long drawn out staff meetings, I'll tell you what they're talking about, because I've been in them. They are talking about each and every one of those 90 players at length. And as a strength coach, once a week, you go through the body weights and talk about who's gaining, who's losing, who might be a red flag, who might be at risk of getting hurt due to weight loss, or who's at risk because of weight gain. And but during the day-to-day staff meetings, and they go over every player every day, you know, when they're really starting to deliberate about a guy, hey, how was he in the offseason program? How was he for you? And a lot of it's attitude. A lot of it is, how was the guy's personality? How is he as a teammate? Talking about every guy. And the scouts you're talking about on draft day, each one of those scouts has the guy they want us to pick. Every one of those scouts has the player they want to be chosen, that they've worked hard scouting during the last college season or what have you, at the pro days, at the combine. And they're waiting for someone to mess up so their guy could get brought in, or they're waiting for a vet that they think should move on so their guy could move up. So everybody's got that vested interest, and the scrutiny is that's what they're spending all that time on. And again, when you, as a strength coach, when you get back to the players and you know, all the BS is gone when you're in the room working with the guys in the weight room, and you try to help and give every guy the best shot that he has and try to help him out. And again, it's that you've been, the end game is that you wind up with the best 53 and give every guy the best chance that you can.
Pretty pretty good. All right, Luke, next one.
The next one, I guess, Tex recently wrote a little article on our blog, Tom, about pregame warmups and what we see at just the younger high school levels. A lot of the guys who follow us are high school coaches or smaller collegiate strength and conditioning coaches. And what I think that's what inspired Sean's question here about at the NFL level, what are athletes doing to prepare for a game? How much of it is like a group 10 count type deal versus individual warm-ups? And do you dictate that, or do they have their own routine? Can you go into detail on that?
Well, I'll just speak first, and then I'll let Tommy finish off this, because I'm sure he has more than this than I do. It's very individual. So the players, I mean, for me, I got there 3 hours ahead of time. I would come in, I would make sure, you know, not only would I get stretched, I'd give attention to anything. I'd do a bunch of contrast baths, making sure I was ready, and then I would stretch out, put on my stuff, and then I would wait to go out to pregame warm-up. There were guys that would go out and run wind sprints. There was dudes out there doing, you know, martial arts stuff. There was other guys that were sleeping, and it was really very individual based. I mean, you played with guys like Hugh Douglas, who wanted to sing Bombs Over Baghdad and sing and dance and yell and scream. And then there's dudes like me who, you know, looked at it like a serial killer. Like, you know, serial killers usually pretty quiet, you know, just cool, calm, and collected. Let's go out and wreck some people. You know, Runyon would drink 27 cups of coffee and would go out and sit on the bench, and we just look at the crowd and look at the birds in the sky. So, I mean, it was very individualized. And then, you know, obviously when we would go out for pregame warm-up, you know, the coach, usually the strength coach, usually took us out because we were the last group as offensive line, at which point we'd go out. And it was always – and then at that point, everything was scripted to the point where we had practices practicing the pregame warm-up. You know, you usually get into lines. The strength coach takes you through the stretches. You bring it – or through the dynamic warm-up, you stretch. You break off and you go over and do your offensive line drills. Then you go offensive and defense. And for me personally, I would make sure I was warm. But when I went out to pregame warm-up with the team, I had this deal in my head that if I did not almost hurt myself, and I did hurt myself on many occasions doing the one-on-one run blocking and the pass pro and all that hitting guys – that if I like walked off the field feeling pretty good, I knew that I wasn't going to have a good game. If I walked off the field like calves tight, back tight, body aching, headache, to the point where I played against Eric Hicks and I ended up giving myself a concussion, and I was actually blind in one eye for about 10 minutes from a couple hits. And I knew that, I'd go in there, I'd take my helmet off, I would sit down, I'd relax, have a drink of water, calm my jets, throw on my headphones, and then I would go out and I was ready to play. And, you know, that was, my pregame situation. But every person that I was around had their own different, little pregame warm-up, pregame ritual. I mean, there were guys that laid out their uniforms on the ground with socks and shoes, like a player, like flattened player, laying on the ground to check their outfits. I mean, you talk about Tommy, I'm sure you'll go into it, about the DBs, you know, every guy coming out with new shoes and, like, you know, comparing outfits and getting their hair braided. I mean, Hollis Thomas and those guys, I mean, they were just, you know, suits and, you know, anything they could. So the pregame, that game day for the NFL is very individualized. And I think the coaches like it that way because it allows each guy to get in their mind and, you know, what do I have to do to perform my best?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I don't know that college, this is an aspect where I don't know that high school needs to copy the NFL because the difference is so immense between the age and where players are in their lives and careers. But as John is saying, he's right on. It's probably 80% or more individual warm-up, and the amount of organized warm-up and preparation with the strength coach, and a lot of the listeners might, you know, be put off or shocked by this, is probably about maybe 5%. And then there's 15% that's organized with the coaches. It's a glorified, quick, high-paced practice periods, like John's talking about, the one-on-one pass pro, the quick seven-on-seven, the team period. And that's very specific. That's position-specific, game-specific. Pads are on, helmets are on. That's a very specific warm-up. You're breaking a sweat going through the exact movements that you're anticipating going through during the game. The 2.5 hours, or I guess it would be, 2 hours prior to the pregame warm-up that's organized with the coaches – every player has their own ritual, and players know what they need. I think in one of the emails I sent back, you know, Jared Allen would sit and listen to the poppiest Cyndi Lauper, 80s Hall & Oates, and Scandal, the Warrior music. You wouldn't believe it. And then he'd go out and wreak havoc on a poor tackle, for four quarters. And as a strength coach, what you're doing, you're there 3 hours ahead. You're the first guy there. You're on the field. And as players come down to the field individually, you're helping them out. You put them through some little agility drills. You put them through some maybe some resistant running, or you give them, you know, hey, Tommy, what's a good warm up for me today? Where I don't want to be sore for the game. I don't want to pull a muscle, but I want to be good and warm. And you're there to provide direction. You have 30-year-old guys. You may have Brett Favre and Tavares Jackson at the same position on the same team, but you know what? They need different things to prepare for a game physically. And like John said, they have their own rituals too. So, and you know, in high school, they probably need more of an organized, predetermined warm-up period with the strength coach, as far as making to ensure that they prevent injuries and so on and so forth. But by the time they get to the league, and as far as the young guys coming in, man, they just kind of follow the vets. They're going to follow, a young lineman's going to watch what John Wellborn does, or he's going to watch what John Runyon does, and kind of do what feels best for him. And it just kind of takes its own path. I'll finish quickly by saying we tried to do an organized, almost like a pre-practice dynamic warm-up before games in Minnesota. I believe it was my first year there. And the head coach said, you know, we warm up as a team before practice, but we don't warm up as a team before a game. It's all these individual guys. Some are stretching in the locker room. Some are on the field warming up, running through some drills. And then we come out and we go right to pregame with the position coaches. And so we brought the whole team out, and John could comment on this. The whole team came out at the beginning of pregame, every group, every position. We warmed up as a team. We went through a stretch, and then we went right to individual drills. Well, shoot, the linemen were out there for this extended amount of time now, because they're usually the final group to come out for pregame, that they were, some of the big dudes were getting worn out and tired out and fatigued. So it didn't even work to treat it like a practice where you all warm up at the same time. They bring the groups out at different times for reasons. And as a strength coach, you're there to help guys with what they need individually. And man, if a guy's got a pregame ritual that's working, he's going to stick with it, and you best encourage it.
I'm curious, how big are the professional strength staffs for the NFL? How many employees you have or coaches with you?
Right now, every staff has three guys at least. In the old days, there'd be one strength coach and you'd have several interns. And it was probably when I was getting into it where it was, they were just coming up with full-time strength and conditioning assistants. You could be it was a full-time coaching position as an assistant strength coach. So probably by the end of the 90s, everyone had a head guy and an assistant, and usually multiple interns, anywhere from 3 to 10 interns that would make a minimum wage salary or just be volunteers getting college credits. And unfortunately, there's been a big change in trying to get started as a strength coach. It's very difficult to be an intern now, because every team is pretty much taking on a third full-time assistant strength coach. So that takes a lot of the salary pie. There's not a lot of that hourly wage to be paying interns to come in. And you can't work for free anymore, which really sucks, because that's how everybody, including myself, got started. Show up, work for nothing. And from what I'm understanding with workers' comp now, even if you're getting college credit, let's say you're attending college UC Irvine, and you want to go, volunteer with or go intern with USC for a semester, you have to be paid to be covered under workers' comp if something would happen. So you can't work for free, which that used to be a big way to get in. So the interns have really dwindled. Unfortunately, there's been a lot of interns that get in for the wrong reasons. They speak against the philosophy. They're young and, you know, they're fired up and they want to, you know, they want to be loyal to their own young, undeveloped philosophy. They come in, they're around millionaires. They're there to get autographs. They're there to get pictures. They're there to, you know, pass business cards around for somebody. So you had to kind of get away from the babysitting. And, but in the end of the day, every staff now, I believe, has three full-time strength coaches and maybe one intern. So no more than four guys per team.
And, I'm curious, how did you decide to go from Miami to the pros?
Well, actually, what happened was I went back from Miami. I went there and I was going to stay full time. I was 23, living in Coral Gables, you know, right near Coconut Grove, South Beach, single guy, man. I would admit to this day, I'd still be in Miami, Florida. Nobody in their right mind going to leave Miami. And what do you know? They offered me a job. I mean, it was an internship back then. I attended Penn State, and they required you to do two internships. One had to be on campus, and you know, like many of your Division I colleges, they had plenty to choose from. You can go to physical therapy, cardiac rehab, intern in the hospital, intern with athletic training. And I chose strength and conditioning. And I, you know, there's a story we can get into where I walked into the football program to, you know, basically let me start with football on campus, let them reject me so that I can move down the chain and just until someone accepts me to work for free. Luckily, they had a brand new strength coach who was sitting there, new on the job, didn't know any of the 100 players. And basically, as the story goes, he told himself, I'm hiring the next punk to walk through the door that's willing to work for free. And there I came walking in all smiles like, hey, Tom Canavy's here. You need anybody to help out for free? You got the job. When's my interview? You just had it. Start tomorrow. So that's how I got started. It was good timing. And now to follow up to your question, I had to choose an internship off campus. And my whole thing was, and to this day, I mean, I am not bashful to just want to go learn from the best. And if I want to, you know, have a lot of success myself at the highest level, I don't want to develop a lot of my own ideas, you know, based on what I did at Valley View High School. I want to go out, learn from the best. Open the newspaper. The number one team in the country was the Miami Hurricanes. I made a phone call and sent a letter. And what do you know? They had me come down. They had a position. And again, they were going to offer me a full-time deal to stay in Miami. But the head strength coach had just left to take a job with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And it's the old story where he wasn't able to bring any assistants with him. And the administration told us, as assistant strength coaches at Miami, it's going to be up to the new incoming guy to keep you guys or bring his own people. So you could hedge your bets on that one. I got a phone call from Penn State to come back. They had a full-time, full-paid position. I would have loved to hang around Miami and seen what would have happened when Dana LaDuke came in. He was the strength coach who replaced Brad Rohl, but I never found out. I jumped in my S10 Blazer, drove all the way back up to Pennsylvania, worked for two seasons at Penn State. Fortunately, we had a lot of success. The first 2 years in the Big Ten, we went 10-2. The second year, 12-0, won the Rose Bowl, made a lot of noise. And as John will tell you, a lot of the teams in the NFL at that time were using that system pretty successfully. And that was a great launching pad. I mean, I had opportunities to go to the NFL as an assistant, which were going to pay better than what I was getting at Penn State. And I worked for a guy who was encouraging me to move on with my career. And if I had a better opportunity, go ahead and take it. It happened to be the Philadelphia Eagles. It was Ray Rhodes' first year, 1995. I would have gone anywhere in the league. It just happened to be, you know, 2 hours away in Philly. And that's what made – I just took the jump because it was a move ahead. I had a full-time job as a college strength coach, but it was very very minimal in pay, and it was a step up financially. And that's why I went to the league, basically just to move ahead.
Good stuff. And I'm sure if you were a college strength coach, you probably wouldn't have as good of stories.
Oh, absolutely not. No. You know, I'll tell you what, though, you'd be surprised that, you know, when you get in the family of the college football team, you know, the shenanigans and the antics that take place, you know, you really get close with the players and there's some characters. Now, when I was at Miami, when I tell you The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, who we all know as being one of the funniest, one of the most charismatic guys in Hollywood, he was not in the top 10 as far as being, you know, charismatic and outgoing and just a crazy character on that Hurricanes team, man. There were some, and even at Penn State, there were some great guys, great times. But but the pros is a whole other level. You know, you're dealing with grown men, with adults, and you know what? There's enough time where it's got to be all business, and it's got to be all business on game day, and when you're practicing, and when you're with the media. So in the weight room, as long as you're working hard, you know, that guys really become themselves, and there's no shortage of characters in the NFL. It's been, I don't know if I could, I don't know what'll happen for me right now, but whatever I do, I don't think I can go 9-to-5 after that, the environment of the National Football League and the characters who fill it out.
That's good stuff. Well, let's roll forward on this last question here. Or I guess it's a two-parter. This comes from one of our guys on the blog again. He said he's watching Hard Knocks and he sees guys with Gatorade bottles all the time. And he's just not buying the fact that the players at that high of a level seem to be on that much sugar throughout the whole day. He's curious if you know, John or Tom can give some feedback. Is that just product placement for the show, or is it is Gatorade have that big of a presence in the NFL?
Gatorade has that big a presence. I mean, Gatorade has the exclusive deal. I mean, what you're seeing with guys drinking Gatorade, I mean, all the trainers, all these guys are clued into Gatorade, so that's actually not product placement. But you know, the there's like this misconception, and you know, obviously the guy who sent the question has this misconception where, oh, I can't believe these guys are on this much sugar. I played with a guy named Al Harris, and Al Harris every day for lunch had chicken McNuggets that were dipped in salt. And that was, you know, his big meal, and he would drink a Coke and eat fries. I played with a guy, you know, Trey Thomas and, you know, some of these other guys that did not worry about a single thing they ate, you know, sitting down consuming 2,000 or 3,000 calories of fried food. So it's really 40 grams of sugar in a Gatorade. That really a big a deal. I think, you know, especially in the, where we are, that, you know, people are looking for, you know, if I eat better, you know, obviously it's going to help me 2 or 3%. I mean, you're talking about guys that, you know, go out and drink every single day, eat whatever they want and do whatever and still come out and kick ass on Sunday. I mean, I watched guys have no worry about their diet, never even blink an eye about what they were putting in their mouth and still be 3% body fat. And you could see their heartbeat through their chest because they were so lean. And, you know, I also, you know, played with guys like Hank Fraley, for example, who was probably 33% body fat and was, you know, jiggled when he walked. But the dude was an incredible athlete, didn't really bust his ass in the weight room, but yet could go out and play, was a natural knee bender, knew how to punch and slide and do all those little things that he was so good at. And, you know, he had the nickname of Honey Bun because he liked honey buns. So, you know, it like... there's this, it's almost like the iron veil. There's this perception that like, oh, these great athletes are doing this and this, and, you know, I can't believe they would be consuming sugar. And you're like, dude, if you're out there busting your ass and doing it, you know, drink some sugar, take some carbs. I mean, carbs are good for performance. You know, personally, I never liked Gatorade. When I would drink Gatorade, I always felt like my legs were heavy and I just didn't really like it. I didn't drink it on game day and I'd always pour it out. Or if I would do it, I'd pour in a bunch of water or just a little bit of Gatorade just to have some taste. You know, there were other guys that lived by it. I mean, for me, if I needed to really rehydrate, I used to drink a lot of Pedialyte. I liked that a little bit better. You know, and at the end of the day, I mean, the Gatorade does taste pretty good. A red fruit punch Gatorade is pretty fucking tasty, especially if you mix it with vodka. So, which Steve Everett showed me, he's like, dude, pour out half that Gatorade, fill the rest up with vodka, shake it up, throw an ice cube in there, and you're good to go. So, you know, we used to make some nasty jungle juice with that stuff too. You get about a whole case of Gatorades, you put it in one of those big, you know, orange containers, and throw everything in there, and it's good stuff.
Everclear?
Yeah. CrossFit has taken a personal vendetta against Gatorade that, you know, overhydrating and pushing this stuff on people is, you know, the devil. But for the most part, you know, there isn't a strength coach or a trainer alive that's just having guys drink Gatorade and not water. I mean, you know, they always tell you, you know, after practice, you know, for every pound you lose, you got to drink, you know, X amount of bottles of water, and you try to mix some Gatorade in there because, you know, electrolytes and salt. The thing that when I came in, and Tommy will remember this, is remember they used to give us salt gum?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. The salt gum. Yeah. And then they got rid of the salt gum. But I'll tell you, on game day, when we went down and played in the hottest game in NFL history, which Tommy will remember, in Dallas, September 1, noon, what did they do? The trainers went out to the store and bought jars of Vlasic pickles and were pouring pickle juice in the cups and giving us water and pickle juice because guys were getting so depleted of every mineral in your body because it's 168 degrees on the field that we were literally slamming. At one point, I remember taking the pickle juice container and like bonging it to my mouth and just doing it and swishing it out, spitting it out and trying to get more in just because the taste in my mouth was just so thick and there was no amount of water I could drink that would be able to cut that spit in my mouth. So, you know, I think it's this idea that like, and this is a totally elitist fucking comment, and hopefully you guys won't fucking kill me for being an elitist, but unfortunately I am a little bit of an elitist. You know, there's this idea that like, you know, and the analogy I always use you know, when people ask me about the NFL and they think that they're all this strength conditioning and this diet and all these secret things, there's all these secret drugs and everybody, you know, I'm like, no, dude, that's the perspective that the mere mortals had for the kings or the gods on Olympia, that they looked up and they made all these ideas that, hey, this is what was going on up there. And I'm like, dude, you're completely fucking wrong. There was, a guy all of a sudden it's because he ate great that was the reason. No, I mean, I've watched guys eat like shit. I've seen guys eat good and I couldn't tell the difference between them. You know, the guy that drank Gatorade, did he perform better than the guy that drank water? Not really. I mean, I played with, you know, I like to bust ass in the weight room. I mean, Tommy and I had some legendary workouts in that off season, but every Friday was our big bang heavy. And from the Field Strong program, what you guys see on Jack Street, which is on Fridays, is directly inspired by my own training and what Tommy and I did. I mean, we would go in there, we'd bench heavy. It was heavy dumbbells, curls, shrugs. I mean, we used to call it the buff and shine, the big pump day. And that was my big day to go and bang weights. But you know what? There were other guys that would stay away from the fucking weight room and never walk a single day in there that still were going out running a 4.3 that were still, you know, let me give an example. Brian Waters. Brian Waters was a guy I played with in Kansas City. Brian was a big, strong dude, 6'1", 6'2", probably about 325 pounds. Went home in the off season, sat on the couch for 4 months, didn't do a single fucking thing. Came back at like 330 pounds, super heavy. Took him about a week or two to start getting in better shape, walk in the weight room, hadn't lifted weights, and proceeded to rep 585 on the bench, which is, for those of you guys, that is six plates. Proceeded to rep that on the bench like it was nothing for a set of five or six. Put it up and looked at me and said, you've been training the whole fucking off season. You can't do that. And you're like, God knows I can't fucking bench 585, let alone bench it for six fucking reps. Now, that's a guy, and that guy still went out and fucking trucked people. Brian didn't worry about what he ate. He just fucking was a beast of a human and, was able to go out and do that job. I mean, we used to fucking argue left and right, but, I mean, you can't argue with results. He went out and he played the game. He lived it and did what he wanted. Now, for me, I couldn't do that. I still had to go and lift weights. I still busted my ass. I ran, I conditioned. I tried to eat well. I got all my blood work done. I used to take my supplements and like everything I needed to do to try to maximize, because unfortunately I did not have, an endless pool of gifts that so many of these guys in the NFL have. So, I mean, there's this perspective that like, you know, all these guys are doing something. No, these guys are fucking phenomenal. And you could put them on a loaf of whole bread and peanut butter diet, and they're still going to get stronger and they're still going to play at a higher level. So, and Tommy could talk about, you know, let's say Adrian Peterson. I mean, he was a weight room warrior, busted his ass, but how shredded is that dude? And I guarantee he's been that shredded since he was about 6 years old.
Yeah. That's the thing. I mean, Adrian is just a great example of when you take extreme genetics and put the work ethic on top of that, of like the undrafted guy who barely has a chance to make the team, and he's going to have to, you know, bust his ass in the weight room and do everything to the nth degree. When you put that kind of a work ethic and consistency with incredible genetics, you get Adrian Peterson. You really do. And that's why he's so special as an athlete, because he's not an under-talented guy who makes up for it with hard work, or he's not a guy that gets by on incredible genetics like the world has never seen. It's the real deal combination on both. I mean, you know, my job with Adrian during the season was to protect him from himself, and, you know, he'd want to – I mean, there's all this reaction to how fast he came back from the ACL knee, and rightfully so, because it was unprecedented. And, you know, so what did you do, and how did you get him back, and how did you work with the medical people and the rehabilitation? The number one thing was just to constantly remind ourselves that it had only been 6 months since he had complete knee reconstruction, and to pull the reins on what he wanted to do. And we would never do nothing. We always did something. And that's why we talked earlier off the air about, you know, using different bars and different implements and different types of equipment. We always did something, but sometimes you have to protect those guys from themselves. And Adrian's a great example of that. He reminds me of Brian Dawkins back in Philadelphia. And John, I think you just missed T.O. by a year or two in Philly, but Terrell Owens, the same thing. I mean, you just talk about tremendous genetics, and the dude just works out on top of that. And that's why these are the guys that really stand out in that combination. But I will say, back to the question, and John said it already, but the Gatorade at NFL facilities, training camp, and all year round is the real deal. Players aren't handed a bottle and told to walk across a camera just because they have a deal with Gatorade. It's everywhere. Now, part of that, and I won't get into, you know, I'm not that familiar with the intricacies of how it works, but Gatorade does have the exclusivity. That's all you can give guys in the National Football League, amongst other pro sports, too. That's all there is. That's everywhere. So, you know, some guys may choose to drink more than others, but it's the real deal. It's everywhere. And I'll say this. I mean, Gatorade is not just a big money corporation throwing money to get a deal here. They provide science and research. They educate the athletic trainers. And so there's a lot to it. And as a strength coach, though, I'll tell you, because that's the only perspective I can speak from here. When it comes to tailoring a diet for a player and you're working with your nutritionist and you're working with the player, you just know that those carbs are already maxed out because of the amount of Gatorade. The simple carbs are going to already be there. So when you're thinking about what a guy needs for glycogen repletion, what a guy needs for recovery, what a guy needs to have his blood sugar stabilized, you have to take into consider the nutritional profile of Gatorade because they drink so much of it. And I think one of the advantages of using that pickle juice back in Dallas when it was whatever it was, 120 degrees, was you were getting the electrolytes into your guy's system without the sugar. And you need the sugar, you need the fuel, of course, but I think the pickle juice provided almost pure sodium. And, you know, that's why you didn't have some of the maybe the adverse effects that could have happened from the sugar or the excess calories. So, you know, it's definitely a real presence, the Gatorade. But you think about when you're planning a diet for a guy, you have to factor in the amount of Gatorade. And, you know, that reminds me of something as well. Sort of the frustration with the nutritional aspect of strength and conditioning is, and John, you'll remember this at Lehigh University during training camp, we had certain guys, and I won't name names, they had a specially crafted meal. They had a special meal made in the back. When they went to breakfast, lunch, and dinner, they got their tray from the back with the exact calories, with the exact nutritional profile, and we thought we had their diet manipulated. Until one day, one of the ball boys, I see him jumping out of the back of an SUV from one of these players who was on the special diet. And the ball boy comes over and he's like, wow, I never saw so many Wendy's and McDonald's wrappers in a car in my life. So we had these special friggin' meals for the guy all day long. And every night he was going and just making up for lost time at McDonald's every night. I remember being, I was in charge of the breakfast club in college at one point where I had to sit with the problem children, the diet problem guys, underweight and overweight. This guy had to have an extra bowl of pasta with his dinner. This guy had to have, low fat. This guy had to have a salad. And we all sat there. Some were linemen, some were receivers, some were DBs. And probably a month into the breakfast club, one night, again, this is back in college. So myself, I'm walking down like the main drag. And who comes up walking out of McDonald's? The entire breakfast club, just all best buddies, too. So every day we had these meticulously planned meals, and every night they were going to McDonald's having happy meals and burger deals and the whole thing. So the diet part of it is very frustrating. And I do want to mention before I forget the Wellborn Friday workouts that we ended up devising and what became our Friday ritual. I will say that was the permanent for every player Wednesday upper body workout for the Vikings for the entire 8 seasons I was there. That was directly inspired by and created on those Fridays at the Vet with Wellborn.
Dude, those were good days, man. We trained in that hole of a gym. I mean, imagine a professional weight room at 1,000 square feet, no windows, dungeon, stuffed with equipment. It was like a converted like broom closet of a gym. I walk in my first day and almost cried. And then I realized, you know what? Like, if anything, this is like Rocky. This is like Rocky going training with Clubber or Apollo Creed, like going back. And I remember calling my brother. My brother's like, what are you talking about, dude? That's where we came from. We came out of a garage.
Yeah.
And you know what? He's like, dude, the strongest people come out of garages where nobody's looking. Those big weight rooms, all that bullshit. You know what? That doesn't build people the same way. And literally we went in there and hammered it every single day. And that was a singular focus. And I remember, putting on body weight, getting bigger and stronger. And I remember when all the other guys came back, everybody was like, what the fuck have you guys been doing? And Tommy's like, this guy hasn't missed a day in 4 months. While you guys are out having a good time, traveling around, fucking living the life. This dude's been living like a monk, training his ass off and here every fucking day. And I was like, dude, it basically set the tone for the rest of my NFL career because I actually was able to kind of shape myself into who I was and create that work ethic, and that became the standard. And then when they fucking nuked the vet, thank God, we went over to this nice big weight room at the NovaCare Center, and you know, a lot of that little bit of grit was lost, but man, we got such a better facility, and you know, we got more bars, more things to play with. And yeah, I mean, like, you know, for me, and I program it on the side, every Friday is always what we call our Jack Street deal. And I, you know, we got the Jack Street thing, and I really never told anybody, but it's actually this idea where, like, you know, hey, like, you're moved on Jack Street, that guy's pretty jacked. I mean, all that stuff comes from, you know, Broad Street, Philly, that whole kind of mentality. It's like, yeah, man, I'm living on Jack Street. So that whole kind of, you know, blue collar grit deal came out of that entire Philly environment. And Tommy was a huge, huge factor in that. And so I'm stoked to have him on and, you know, be able to tell a little bit about it. But, you know, what's killer is, you know, I think, you know, as a strength coach, at least, you know, for me, like, you know, that's the guy you hope for. You hope that somebody comes in chomping at the bit where you got to back them off. It's the guys where you got to put the taskmaster whip to their back and force them, chase them around, fine them, fucking go to the coach and say, so-and-so missed his fucking workout. Or if he comes in, he bullshits it and doesn't do it. As a strength coach, I mean, that's the fucking tedious part of the job. I mean, the guy that, you know, like, we used to have these epic battles on Fridays, and Tommy was mentioning his twin brother, Darwin Walker, earlier off camera or off radio. And Darwin was a defensive lineman that played at the University of Tennessee. Was a pretty smart dude. I think he was like a structural engineer, but was a complete fucking moron in terms of a human being, in terms of how to deal with people and be around it. And so he was pretty strong weight room guy. So he used to like to try to come in and jump in on the Friday workouts. And, you know, he was, you know, strong dude. So it was always good. And I used to battle him a lot because he played, you know, the three technique and even the one. So it was pretty good to be able to compete with somebody like that. And he was a strong dude.
Yeah, no, I always loved the interaction, the exchange with you and Darwin Walker. And, you know, Philadelphia, man, in those days, in the early 2000s under Jim Johnson, we had a lot of great defensive linemen. I mean, the list goes on and on, from Corey Simon and Hollis Thomas and guys that played very effectively. But Darwin was a big part of that. And Darwin was definitely the most weight room of the defensive linemen from that era. And he was, I don't know if he was the, you know, the compared to John Wellborn, similar, you know, smart, from good universities. I think Darwin went on to be the have his own engineering company or whatever, but there was the innate or the inherent hatred, you know, slash respect of an offensive guard and a defensive lineman. And you guys, you know, sometimes brought the best out of each other, but Darwin was a weight room guy. He was strong in the weight room, you know, naturally strong. And of course, John was a weight room guy too. And yeah, you guys would battle it out on those Fridays. And but what a great interaction between you and Darwin. I mean, that's where a lot of players, they got more interested in doing the extra work because, you know, we had to have a plan. We had to have that template, that basic program that everyone had to go through to make sure that they were balanced structurally, that they were balanced in their strength, that they were durable for the games. And then, but what could we do outside the box? And, you know, as an assistant strength coach, I was learning from the players as much as they were learning from me, maybe more. I mean, I learned a lot from what you were doing with Todd Rice out at Cal and other places that you went on to train in the off season. And I brought a lot of that with me to the Vikings and helped, you know, kind of when it came to cultivating my own philosophy. I took a lot from a lot of places where I've worked directly and a lot from what I learned from other players. And when I'm telling you, you know, a lot of people might not understand in the NFL, typically you'll come the day after a game. That's a team workout day, and that's the day to get the lower body done. You're getting your lower body training on a Monday, even though it's a day removed from the game. You can't make players work out on a Tuesday because that's their contracted day off. But you're doing lower body on Monday, and then Wednesday or Thursday, you come back for an upper body workout. Everything else is kind of extra. Everything else is optional. And in Philadelphia, which was very in vogue and very effective at the time, the upper body workout was a very basic, full upper body, push-pull, very balanced, you know, higher reps that would over time get lower. And then on Fridays, you'd get the guys who wanted to come in and, you know, and really bang the iron and start moving the steel. And who's kidding who, John? Early in the day, you wanted to come in and bench, man. That's all that mattered was bench, bench, bench. And again, Wolfie would turn me over to the weight room maniacs like you and Brian Dawkins and guys like that. And I remember, okay, what am I going to do here? This guy just wants to bench and bench and bench. And we're all about balance. So, okay, well, John, we'll bench as heavy as you want. as long as we get good and warmed up and we handle weights that we think we can master. But you agree to balance it off with some, I don't know, some body weight pull-ups or something like that. Then let's throw in some shoulders, and then we'll add some, you know, shoulder matrix or something like that. And I mean, it became so effective and so many guys wanted to get in on it. I'm telling you, from day one with the Vikings, we did a lower body workout every Monday, and we did a little bit of upper body to recover from the game. When the guys came back for that upper body workout Wednesday or Thursday, year in and year out, that was that Friday special, the Jack's Street workout, so to speak.
Yeah, well, for me, I would always come in and we'd always squat heavy and do something big pull or something big leg based on that Monday. And then, like Tommy said, it was a day off, so they couldn't require us there. But for me, I always came in and trained on Tuesday and I'd do some light upper body. Then I'd take off Wednesday, come in and I'd do some light legs on Thursday. And then Friday was the heavy bench day. And like, you know, the big pusher day, seated dumbbells, you know, neutral grip bench with the heavy dumbbells. We do a bunch of heavy bench. I mean, the big deal was we always had to work up to, and it didn't really matter the reps. I mean, obviously in the beginning part of the season in training camp, it was like 405 for, you know, let's say a set of like 5 to 10 reps or even 12 reps early on. And then as the season went on, the reps would start cutting back. And, you know, we would always still get 405 on the bar. And if it was, hey man, I'm banged up, but I still can press this for, you know, 3 or 4 reps or even a single, let's say, I knew that as long as I went in and hit that 405 for at least a few singles, I was ready. And I was okay with that mentally because I was still handling a heavy weight. Now, obviously, I wasn't getting as many reps as I used to, but I wasn't expecting to because here we are, you know, playing, you know, every Sunday out there banging 70 plays, hitting this and that. And you got to realize that, hey, you know what, that's going to take a toll and I'm just not going to be able to get the same amount of reps, but I was never going to dial back, you know, the intensity. And so really where I came with my program design is I realized that I could recover from intensity. It was the volume that fucking crushed me. So early on when my recovery was great, the volume was higher. And then as time went on, I never decreased intensity. I kept intensity high and I just backed off the volume. And then always, you know, the classic bodybuilding stuff, I mean, that we learned, it's, you know, people kind of thumb their nose out of it. But you know what, in terms of, you know, keeping the muscles strong and you're doing so much pushing and pulling and battling on the field, that coming in and doing some single jointed movements for the triceps and the elbow health and working the biceps, doing the hammer curls, benching, you know, doing shoulders, you know, doing all these kind of basic movements that we do in our Field Strong and you guys see in our power athlete stuff. I mean, really, that's where that whole, you know, idea came from. And it was like, shit, man, you know, part of the reason was we would bang heavy after practice on Friday. It was the first day I felt great of the week. And then, you know, head home and, you know, go out that night and hopefully have some fun and then come in the next morning, try not to throw up a pregame warm up because we're at a pre-practice on Saturday because we drank too much on Friday and then go out and play Sunday.
It was the basis of the program we did at the Vikings. And you know, we had our ups and downs in Minnesota, but we were always a physical team for those 8 years. I mean, we averaged top five in run defense and run offense under those 8 years that I was there. We were number one least in the league of players on injured reserve. So we were durable as well. And kind of in a nutshell, you know, we started the conversation with talking about my philosophy. And I can't really give it a name, you know, because you have intensity and volume and different variables and things that you incorporate. But that the workout that you were describing, you lead off with a technical lift, a power lift. You know, the off-season program is different where the primary lift, we would have a clean day, a variation of a clean. We'd have a push press day. Those would be our two Olympic style days. And then we'd have two lower body days. One would be we'd have a squat day as well. And then, of course, you had your bench day. But to encapsulate that program or that workout you were talking about, you begin with a measurable lift, whether it's the bench press, the squat, or the clean. And that's your primary lift. That's your measurable, your trackable lift. And then you complement it by balancing it with a posterior movement just to make sure that your development is going to be balanced. And then you come in with something hypertrophy, stamina, working to failure, high intensity. And to me, that's not as much of a bodybuilding thing as it is as a joint stabilization thing. So we'd always follow the power or the technical movement or the heavy power movement with some sort of hypertrophy slash stamina. It could be dumbbells. It could be a machine. It could be chains. It could be a rope or what have you. And then we'd finish with injury prevention. And then we do some of the solo joint things at the end. And that was kind of what that Friday workout became. And the reason I adopted it as a part of the mandatory routine, John, like you were saying, you and so many other guys, you felt ready after that workout. You know, you were ready for the game. You were ready for the for game day. And you felt like you did something other than at the time the standard upper body was, you know, one movement per plane of motion, you know, good technique, higher reps. It was about being durable, maintaining your strength and range of motion. But that Friday was a real lift day, and guys need to feel like they have that lift in, you know, psychologically. So, you know, to this day, it's an effective formula.
Well, the, you know, my idea, and I didn't really realize it until I actually, you know, got a little older in the NFL and started actually kind of, you know, going through a lot of the physiology and started learning a little bit about this stuff, you know, that higher intensity type stuff is going to be more CNS efficiency and it's going to be more neurological based. And for me, I needed that kind of constant tuning of the CNS and that neurological base because of what we did on the field. I mean, practice is such a different animal because you're moving the whole time, you're going through it. But when you go out on the field, imagine 70 one RM reps. So I'm going to squat this, you know, I'm going to put, you know, 95% or 100% or 105% of my best 1RM back squat. And I'm going to squat that in terms of singles. And I'm going to do it, let's say I might do it 3 plays in a row. I might do it 18 plays in a row, but I'm not going to deviate. And I'm going to be able to do somewhere around 60 or 70 total reps in different variations and different sets. And that level of efficiency. And I remember going back and reading some of the Zadiskorsky stuff and understanding the physiology and why it was working for me was because when I looked at the demands of the game and that kind of, you know, 1RM efficiency of the central nervous system, that ability to harness motor units and get maximal, you know, contractions and, you know, all that good stuff. I looked at each rep in the NFL as I got down to my stance every Sunday and would, you know, fire off the ball with 100% intensity. And so my whole deal was, how do I recover the central nervous system? You know, for me, it was like I knew that I could recover from the intensity portion. It was just the volume that was crushing me. So I couldn't handle the same volume day in and day out if I was giving myself 70, 100% efforts. So when I looked at how to design the training and, you know, I, you know, even took some of the West Side stuff where it was like, hey, we're going to work up to something heavy and then I'm going to get all my volume in terms of my assistance work, which isn't as hard on my central nervous system. So the program seemed to work and, you know, was very successful for me and it's been very successful for a lot of other people that have used it. And no, I mean, it's, you know, the being able to play in the season is about what do I need to do to be successful. When you get to the off season, that's where shit gets fun. That's where you get to go out and you get to try new things and you get to put in, let's say you want to do more conditioning, you want to do more running, you want to bang heavier weights, you want to squat, you want to pull, you want to do all of these things because I have 6 months to figure it out, 7 months to figure it out. When you get into training camp in the season, you've got to have a plan. You got to know what you're doing and there's no time to fucking go out and ad lib, make up, try this. Hey, here's muscle fitness. Try this. No, dude, we're not doing that bullshit. We're going with what's tried and true. What's got me to where I is, to where I am and what's helped me, you know, play at a high level all these years. So, you know, and then what's great for a guy like Tommy is as he's around different players and he was an assistant in Philly, he got to see what worked for, like you mentioned, guys like Darwin and Brian Dawkins and myself and, you know, other athletes that came through this deal. And then, you know, you go and you get your head job at Minnesota and he gets to work with my young protege and good friend, Jared Allen, which, you know, as we had Jared on the podcast a couple months ago. And I mean, I remember Jared coming in as just a young kid, bright eyed, bushy tailed, you know, looking for something. And when we lived together, he knew that every Friday we were going to lift heavy weights and I had to drive him because he had 3 DUIs and didn't have a license. And I would fucking be like, hey, man, I'm not going home. If you want to go home, you're going to have to hitch a ride with somebody else. And he would stay and he would train. And I think seeing that was good for him. And then he goes on and now he's a fucking superstar.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, John, on the training, I'll say, you know, you hit it on the head where you have to find out what works during the season. And that's why when you plan out that linear periodization or your basic format, you have to be ready to change on the fly. And in the off season, you know, there's no games that you're preparing for. So you're not as worried about overtraining or fatigue or high volume crushing you. So but all the benefit you get for the CNS activation, for the increase in muscle contractile velocity, fast twitch muscle fiber development. You can't abandon that during the season. So what do? And you have to be willing to learn. I'm still learning, you know, 23 years as a strength coach, learning what to do. And one of those great learning moments was, okay, you need to maintain some of that weightlifting during the season, you know, it's the CNS activation. But the key to not overtrain or to risk unnecessary injuries decreasing the volume, maintaining the intensity, especially as the season wears on. The worst thing to do is say you're going to go to a maintenance plan. No, maintain the intensity. If you could step up the weight, step up the weight, no matter what the percentages say, or no matter when the textbook says go to a maintenance phase. No, if you can go heavier, but less reps, less sets. Maintain power training, maintain a thorough nature of your routines, maintain balanced development, but decrease the volume over time. And it's something that works, but you're keeping that weightlifting mentality in during the season as well. And, you know, the profession evolves over time. And I absolutely learned, when Adrian Peterson got to the Vikings as a number one draft choice with a storied career at Oklahoma, I was asking him a ton about Oklahoma. And I think what he was expecting was, you know, the usual lecture, well, forget everything you did in high school, forget what you did in college. I could give a rat's ass about what you did at Oklahoma. You're a Viking now, we're doing it this way. I'm like, dude, tell me more about Jerry Schmidt in Oklahoma. What did you guys do on Sundays? Did you lift on Sunday after a Saturday game or Monday? And you learn from people. Jared's the greatest case ever. I mean, you know, he's one of my favorite people in the world. You and I both. He's got the best personality, but he's a very, very hard worker, extremely serious about his training all year round. And, you saw him from when he was the bright-eyed, bushy-tailed young guy in Kansas City. When we signed him, Mr. Big Time, he was the highest paid defensive player in the league.
He called me and screamed. I will never have to say sorry again. He was screaming that on the phone when he's like, I just got signed and I made enough money to never have to say sorry is what he was screaming. And I was like, God bless you. I love it. And you know what? He's never said sorry ever since then.
No, he absolutely hasn't. You know, and let's give him his due now, and let's not, blow too much smoke or be, too overdo it here. But how many times is there a blockbuster signing and you give up 5 out of 7 draft picks, basically give away your whole draft for a year? Because you know what? Our defense is just one notch away. We need a pass rush. And that's all we need. We have the best run defense in the league. We have defensive backs. We just need more of a pass rush. We're going to tab you. And we could go through the year after year who the big blockbuster deal is. And Jared was the guy that year, 2008. And he casually comes in and just gets the job done. I mean, it's so rare that all the pressure is being put on this guy, the focus, the scrutiny. You're coming in to provide a pass rush. And he goes in, half a sack away from the single season record. And we had a great pass rushing defense all the years he was there. Basically, he came in and answered the bell and earned every dollar of that deal and actually played the whole deal out. But my first experience with Jared was, we didn't have much. We had every year, every team, as you know, John, has a draft party where they invite the fans to come to the facility or to a convention center, and they have a big party for the draft. And, you know, everyone can't wait every round to see who the local team is going to take. All the fans are there. Well, we had no draft because we traded all the picks away for Jared. So Jared comes to town. He's going to be the life of the party. He's going to be the only guest at the draft party. And it was that day he comes running in the weight room. He's got all the energy in the world. He knew our linebackers coach, Fred Puggage. They had been in Kansas City together.
Yeah, Pug.
And so him and Pug come in the weight room. And Jared turns the corner, flies in the office, and I know he's a guy who's going to be, very determined about how he needs to train, set in his ways, a veteran guy. And most guys that are like that, they want to avoid the strength coach. They want to avoid the confrontation. They want to just basically tell someone else to tell the strength coach, hey, I want to do my own thing. I don't want to do, I'm sure the program here is good. Jared came right in face to face, gave me a handshake and a hug. I'm glad to be here, dude. I'm so fired up, man. This is so awesome, dude. I want to work out today. But I have to tell you, man, I have this workout formula I've been doing, and it's kind of been working for me. And it's kind of like, it's the reason I'm here. And some strength coaches might get, put off or insecure about that. Like, oh God, here comes a guy that's not going to do our program. The young guys are going to follow him. So I said, Jared, hey, pump the brakes, buddy, pump the brakes, just settle down. I want to know what you're doing. Obviously it is working. Maybe we can, get the whole team better with a little input from you. So what I did was I pulled out a card. Every strength coach has their workout chart, the workout card. I said, here's our, here's our Monday routine, Jared. And I just threw it right off the side of the desk. I pulled out a blank card with nothing on it. I said, you and I are going to sit here right now, and we're going to figure out your workout. and we're going to start with this. Here's, we would start with, you know, here's our warm up. All right, dude, that's cool. We're going to squat. And what would you normally do next? Okay, after squats, I would go do some sort of a RDL or something like that. That's great. You know what? That's absolutely, that's actually what we do here. Do you do an isolateral movement? Do you do a single leg movement? Yeah, actually, we basically, he was doing our program and we had a couple of tweaks and a couple of changes and maybe a change of equipment here and there. At the bottom of the card, I wrote sack the quarterback. That's the bottom line. That's it. All this stuff we're doing here, we're doing four-way neck, we're doing squat, we're doing bench, we're doing biceps curls. You know, we're going to do this and then sack the quarterback. We high five and the rest is history. So Jared's an interesting character, and that was my first experience with him. And, you know, dealing with big-time players that have strong attitudes and strong-willed guys about training, if you don't want to deal with it, don't be a pro strength coach. You know, just have your own place and expect everyone to come in and do whatever you have on the board for the day. But to me, some of the fun of it is the challenge dealing with an Adrian Peterson who, oh, all of a sudden now he's not allowed to squat. And shoot, that's his bread and butter. What do? You have to know what to do. You know, here comes a weight room gym rat, John Wellborn, but it's week 13. He's not really feeling, he's a little grumpy today. How am I going to handle that? Different. Here comes the highest paid defensive player in the league, and he's coming in talking about doing his own program. How are you going to handle that? You have to enjoy the challenge, or you just got to find something else to do.
Hey, Tom, before we get off topic, when you do have those days where you're just going to shake plates or get the guys going, or you yourself train hard and you want to, like, you need a little bit of outside influence, we've been playing around on Spotify with some playlists. What can you name 4, 5, or 6 tracks off the top of your head that if you could control the tunes, you would throw on to make people, you know, get after it?
Oh, yeah, man. You got to get Psychosocial by Slipknot. Yeah. I don't know what it is, man. That your worst weight room performers will turn into beasts. They will win the CrossFit Games if you play Psychosocial by Slipknot. And I, you know, obviously, you know, weight room music, you could have a whole podcast, a whole show on that, because, you know, when it comes to professional athletes coming to blows and wanting to physically fight each other, I think you have, you know, politics, and then religion, and then defending your wife's honor, and above that is weight room music. Guys will want to kill each other over what's played in the weight room.
But who dictates? Whoa! Who dictates? Who dictates what music is played?
The vets pick the music. Absolutely right. The senior vet picks the music. And who's kidding who? It's a battle between heavy metal and hip hop half the time. And then when there's a battle between two vets, the whole thing. But that Psychosocial, there's something about it that everybody just goes nuts, man. We had this receiver, Robert Ferguson from Green Bay. Great guy, great receiver, and a big weight room guy too, a weightlifting receiver. And if he heard Psychosocial in the weight room from all the way down in the trainer's room or the locker room, he would come storming in the weight room, start banging his head, adding place to whatever guys were doing. So number one, I would definitely go with Psychosocial at the top of the list. Number two, out of respect and for my good friend John Wellborn, I got to go with Dragula by Rob Zombie. That one never disappoints. That's definitely high energy. And personally, I'd go Skeletons of Society by Slayer. That's just old.
Tommy, but I, you know, it would be remiss if we didn't talk about Alice Cooper and your same Halloween costume every single year.
Yeah, I still have to this day. It doesn't matter. I dress up as Alice Cooper. He's my inspiration. He's the icon. I look at him as a pioneer who, you know, he took a lot of influences but made something into his own and forged ahead. And I can only hope to do the same in my chosen profession. I mean, everyone should look to Alice Cooper. And at the end of the day, just a great heck of a guy, just a really, really good dude. And every Halloween, I will pay respect to Alice by dressing up, even if it's if we're getting back from Monday Night Football and we're landing at 7 a.m. and Halloween's on a Tuesday or whatever, I will at some point do the Alice dress up. Absolutely. In fact, for weight room sake, look up a cover of No More Mr. Nice Guy by Megadeth. Just a blistering version tribute to one of the greatest classic rock songs ever.
Okay, I was going to say 17, but that's No More Mr. Nice Guy is a good one. What else? So we got Dragula, we got Slipknot, Slayer, Raining Blood.
I'd go Skeletons of Society. That's got, for the hip-hop crowd, man, if you could get some heavy metal that's got a great beat, it kind of gets the whole room going. That's why I think Slipknot, like you try to play something like Alice in Chains, which I love, even a lot of the Metallica, it's just sometimes it's got that just that heavy, that Black Sabbath-y stuff, and you have to really be into metal for it. Now, I could play that all day long, and certain guys like yourself, you would just love it. You know, Steve Everett would go bonkers, but to get – To get the whole room rocking, man, it has to be something with that beat and that repetition, and that's what Slipknot's got, and that's what Skeletons of Society has. No More Mr. Nice Guy, and that's the heaviest stuff. I mean, that's what I would go with.
And yeah, I always like Metallica Hit the Lights, because when we would walk into that little shitty weight room, it was like, hit the lights, and that was always the good one to get us going. So yeah, Metallica Hit the Lights was another one. But you know who was the big Slipknot guy? Was Brzezinski. He loved those guys and Gwar. Remember that? When Brzezinski reached out to Gwar, and they used to come to the games, and they'd hang out in the parking lot, Odorous Horungus and those idiots.
Oh, my God.
And we would sit there and drink beers with the guys from Gwar. And, you know, so...
They had a Friday show in Philly. You know, we'd get invited to the show and we'd get backstage and check out the costumes and the whole thing. And then they'd come to the game, and you couldn't get personal friends on the sidelines, but you could get them to pregame, like John was talking about before. You could bring as many people as you want, get them a pass to stand on the field during the pregame warmups. And whenever Gwar was in town, it was like, oh, my God, if we get in trouble for this, let's blame Doug, because he's the Gwar fan. Because they weren't in costume, but, I mean, they might as well have been. They were, you know, just these big big dudes with tattoos and, you know, earrings and stuff. And they always caused a spectacle. But, yeah, God rest his soul. Dave Brocky, Odorous Urungus, just passed away not too long ago. But
I didn't know that. Well, the other big one was WMMR had me take the guys from Drowning Pool, when they came to town, I had to take them out and get them tattoos, and got to go party and hang out with them, and then got on stage and got to, while Dave, the lead singer, was passed away, you know, was wearing my jersey, and I helped them sing Let the Bodies Hit the Floor, which is the, probably been beat to death, like any horse gets beat to death, with a great song in the CrossFit community. I don't know how many times I walked into a CrossFit gym to hear Let the Bodies Hit the Floor, and while most people are like, oh, not this song, it leaves a little bit of a tear in my eye, because those guys were fucking awesome and had a great time with them and got to get up on stage and sing with them at the, was that the Electric Factory?
That was Electric Factory, yep.
Yeah, the Electric Factory.
That makes me feel old, because now, you know, I still think of Drowning Pool. I'm 44. I think of them as kind of still new. And, man, you were still in Philly and hanging out with them back in Philly. That's, you know, that makes me feel old now. But they were a great band. They were came and went quick, but they were great.
Well, and then coming from Scranton, I obviously with the mullet, you know, Tommy still had a mullet up until when I first met him in their late 90s, early 2000s.
And it was a social mullet?
Yeah, he used to rock a mullet. But, you know, I think AC/DC, you were a big AC/DC guy. I think you almost ended up with an AC/DC tattoo, as I remember.
Oh, yeah. AC/DC is there. That's the religion in Scranton, Pennsylvania. That's sacred. You know, that you play, everybody stops and what they're doing and pay attention if AC/DC comes out of Northeast Pennsylvania. It's the part of the fabric up there too. And there's nothing more glorious than blasting for those about to rock in your Camaro with the T-tops off and the top of your hair staying in place and the back of it flowing in the wind. I mean, you know, hanging the left gun out the window. Shoot, talk about chick magnet.
Tommy, what was the story you told me about St. Patrick's Day when you went to that? What was the name of the bar you went to, and you ended up passing out in the bathroom with the green gloves on, and you were in there for like 2 hours, and the old lady started yelling at you?
Well, of course, the only reason I was just resting. I mean, I wasn't passing out from any type of botchery or, you know, excess whatsoever. But, you know, they're pretty proud of the Irish heritage up there in Scranton. They start pretty early in the morning. And what happened was, I think they opened the first establishment at about 5:30 a.m. for kegs and eggs. And got in there and had my kegs and eggs and were having fun. And I was walking past a place called Tink's. Irish establishment, And I went in there and I just had to use the restroom facility. That was it, like any other human being. And they said, oh, no, no, customers only. The place was packed. It was the St. Patrick's Day parade was going on. And I had these two fingerless green gloves on. That's what I remember. I bought these, you know, old school Irish gloves without the fingers. Very tough, very Scranton, very, you know, Rocky Balboa. And I said, fine, fine. I said, listen, get me a tuna sandwich. I'll be right back. And I ran in the bathroom because now I'm a customer. And about an hour and a half later, everyone's pounding on the door. And I just remember opening my eyes and seeing these two green gloves sitting on the commode there and saying, what happened? What's going on here? They said, your tuna sandwich has been out here for an hour and a half. No one knew what happened to you. But the things you have to do to use a public restroom in Scranton, Pennsylvania, on St. Patrick's Day, I'll tell you.
So I was telling Luke about it, and like I was like, he's like, oh, just give me a good Canavie story. And I was like, well, that's the other one. And then the other good one was that year, you telling me that story and me going over to Finnegan's wake at 5:30 in the morning. And I show up at like, you know, like the bar opens at 6. I show up at 5:30 and there's a line of like 75 people out the door in line waiting to go in and get the first drink. It's, you know, before work, 6 a.m. And I was like, it was cold. I mean, this was, you know, March 17th in Philly. So it was still snow on the ground. And I remember being like, you know, because up until that point, I kind of hated Philly. I was like, oh, this place is such a shithole. And then upon seeing that, I was like, if people are going to get up to get this drunk on a Tuesday morning at like, you know, 5:30 and I show up and it took me like an hour to get in line, stand out in the cold to get in there and Finnegan's wakes like a literally it's probably the size of a coffin and going in there and hammering it up. And no, it's good. It was a good time, man. Those were good days.
Yeah, yeah. Pennsylvania's it's a great place, man. I mean, they work hard, play hard. You know, that's where I'm from. Those are my people. I love it there. And plenty of good stories, plenty of good stories. I'm glad you got to experience Philadelphia for as long as you did. You definitely, definitely enjoyed it. I wish I could have got you to Scranton a little bit more than we were able to. But, you know, we still have to go back. And I'll leave I want everyone to remember, if you want something very entertaining, and this is the number one conversation piece. If I just hang a picture of this in the weight room office, any photo, any visual from an event called Saint Ubaldo Day, also known as the Race of the Saints, please Google it. Please look it up. Print it out. Learn about it. It will make St. Patrick's Day, the entire spectacle, the pageantry, the debauchery, the partying, everything, believe it or not, takes a backseat to an Italian holiday that's only celebrated two places in the world, one small town in Italy and one small town outside of Scranton, Pennsylvania. It is the best kept secret in holidays, in partying, and in professional sports. And I'll leave you with that. St. Ubaldo.
Yeah, no. Canavie's been trying to round us up to run in the Ubaldo race, and we'll yes. post a picture of Tommy from the newspaper. It's literally like these wooden standards with the saint, and you race it around, and then you have to run up this hill and bury it in the hill, and it turns into just this big bloodbath. And, you know, needless to say, when I was telling Luke about it before we got on here, the smile across his face was so big, and he's like, you know, physical exercise, beer, violence, just debauchery, morons, yeah. Having a good time with red sashes on is right up his alley. So I was like, man,
yes.
if Canadian could you know, get all of his friends from the NFL to come back and win and race the Ubaldo, you'd be fucking stoked.
We'll put it this way. It's every high school athlete that aspired to play in college but didn't make the cut or couldn't get it done. Every failed athlete, this is their day. It's May. It's every Memorial Day. It's their day to relive the high school glories, as they would say in Days of the Confused. So you can imagine the cast of characters. It's about 150 of me running in this race, dressed like it's the running of the bulls, right down to the scarf and the sash. It's a race where you're holding an 800-pound statue on your shoulders, a team of 10 guys. About every 100 yards, you switch in and a new team – you switch out and a new team from – a new group from your team switches in. So people fall down. Their faces hit the pavement. Their arms end up in manholes and drain ditches and everything else. And the best part about this race is you can't pass each other. You just run down the street in single file, screaming and yelling, and have the biggest party you've ever seen at the night.
Tex, this is you and me. Tommy, let's
start the team.
But at one point, wasn't it a race? And then didn't some like old lady get trucked, and then they had to change it because it was getting too violent or something?
Yep, they tell the people on the sidewalks to please stand back when the Saints are coming running by. They have all this pageantry. They have a guy on a horse that leads the Saints down the street. They have a police car behind him with the sirens going. They tell all the kids and the mothers to back up on the sideline. The Saints are coming. The Saints are coming. The runners are going to be switching in and out and running into the crowd. And some old lady said, hey, don't tell me what to do, you young whippersnapper. When I was a little girl, I lived in Italy, and I used to see the rain, and boom, she got ran over. And she got blasted because we used to – I shouldn't give away any of these old stories here, get anybody in trouble. But in Italy, it's supposed to be a procession and a celebration of the three saints, the patron saints of this town. And you don't disrespect the lead saint because Saint Ubaldo is the one who saved the village back during the invasions. It's a whole long story. It's more of a celebration and a procession. Well, you know, you get some – drunk Americans to do their version of the race. We made the Saints a little bit lighter, and we're actually passing each other off, which is a big no-no. That's something you're not supposed to do. So, you know, she didn't appreciate getting run over, and she thought it lost a lot of its religious relevancy and a lot of the meaning of the day. So they did. They ended up banning it for about 10 years for a number of reasons, and then they just brought it back about 15 years ago. And I'm telling you, John, we got to get a group together because Jared Allen, he's done the running of the bulls, and he's paratrooped, and he's base jumped, and he's gone hunting in Africa. And this is on his bucket list. He's going to come over and run one day. In fact, if you see the gift I had to send, he went and decided to get married on Memorial Day, on St. Ubaldo Day. He gets married in Chicago, and I couldn't make the wedding.
I was there, and if you had shown up, I would have probably walked up and punched you square in the back and then probably followed that up with a fucking nut shot.
Well, yeah, of course. Well, I wouldn't have it any other way. I would expect nothing less.
Exactly.
That was every day. So you and Jared got to make it in for that. Everyone else, just look up St. Ubaldo Day. It is a classic. But if you notice, I may have sent you the picture. If I didn't, I will. I felt so bad about missing Jared's wedding that I had to send him the best wedding gift. And, you know, there were millionaires at his wedding and lifelong friends. I had to outdo everyone. So he always said my high school pictures with my mullet, I was nothing less than a heartthrob. A lot of people make fun of my high school mullet and, you know, the way we looked in 1988. And he said I was John Stamos had nothing on me whatsoever. So I sent him a framed picture of my high school track photo with my mullet and my track uniform in a heart-shaped frame. And I said, don't be afraid to just unwrap this and unveil it and put it on the gift table at your wedding. So, Wellburn, I hope you got to see and enjoy that gift that I sent.
I did, and the best part is when I asked Canavy about his mullet, it was purely by accident. They just were like, had, you know, hair was growing long, so they just started shaving the sides. Mm-hmm. And next thing you know, he just had a mullet. So Canavy actually at one point claimed to me that he invented the mullet, and the mullet in the invention came from Scranton.
Yes, and, it did.
Spread everywhere like herpes on spring break. So you know what, though? But having seen the pictures, I don't know if it's right or not, but you know what? I like the story better.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it was 1982, and I had to go for a haircut. And I said, listen, I'm trying to grow long hair like a rock and roller. I'm trying to look like a rock star here. And the problem is my hair defies gravity. It's thick, and it grows straight up. So I said, why don't we do this? I said, just cut the top. Let the back go, so when it all grows in together, it'll be, you know, it'll be more balanced at the time. And by not cutting the back and just cutting the top, hence the birth of the mullet, 1982. A month later, Rick Springfield's number one on the charts wearing my haircut.
That's great.
Oh, shit. Well, I think that's a great ending. I think that's the perfect place to end. Honestly, Tommy, we could talk for like 7 hours, dude. So,
You know, but anytime, it's a blast.
Yeah, no, dude, thanks for having thanks for coming on, dude. We're stoked to have you, and I think it's great information. It's just great to catch up and fucking bust your balls and hear some of these stories. It brings a lot of smiles to my face. So, thank you, Migo, dude. It's been great, and fuck, dude, thanks for coming on.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys. You guys have been great. Dealing with everybody's been terrific. I'm honored to do it. I really am. It's a lot of fun. There's not enough hours in the day, not enough days in the week to cover everything that we could, training and otherwise. But I will say, you know, it's been different for me the last few months now. First time I'm not with a team in so many years. And John, you know how important it is to have those years in. Those vested years, and I've got them all. So I've been spending time getting around and visiting places, coast to coast, Arizona, back to Jersey. And wherever I go, when they find out I work for the Eagles and that I know John Wellborn, they have a lot of these trainers, I'm telling you, world-class guys. They want to know about CrossFit football and Power Athlete and what you're up to and what your background is and what you guys are all about. So you guys are definitely out there on the radar. And I want to wish everyone nothing but the best, and hopefully we'll get to wrap again sometime.
Yeah, Tom, we'd love to have you on again, amigo. Thank you.
Well, next time you're out west, Tom, come on by.
I'd love to, man. Looking forward to it.
All right. Yeah,
Tom, thanks for giving Luke and I a new goal here with this Jessup's race.
Look it up. It's for real.
All right, man.
All right, Tommy. Guys. Thanks, brother.
All right, take
you guys have a great weekend.
You too.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Tom.